he goes away from there because the First World War breaks up.
And foreigners cannot stay in India. So her husband, Paul Richard, was called back, saying you have to come back to France. And within 1 year, they go away. But staying there for 1 year, she comes back to Japan, 1916. Well, I have to cut short a lot of my, very beautiful things. Now I really believe Manik Bhai that I wish I stayed longer. Well, however, there's always a next time, I suppose. So, because when we speak on mother, there's been so much of personal attachment and personal experience and so many things we know about mother. Maybe time is a bar to speak about her. Well, I see some of you looking at your watches. So we'll end here. So this was the first manifestation of the mother. Because what I'm driving through all my talks on the mother is that she is the force and power of manifestation. Well, I'll take you through this stage. Give me another 5 minutes, okay? Can I have another 5-7 minutes?
Sure.
Right. So, I'll skip a few important incidents, I'll tell you. Now, this is when she came to Pondicherry, she did that first thing. She got that eternal wisdom from Sri Aurobindo. And after that, she goes to Paris, and within 1 year, she comes back to Japan. And imagine, Japan was not a safe place. But she comes to Japan and stays there for 4 years, 1916 to 1920. People asked her, Mother, why Japan? Why did you go to remain in Paris? But you see, as I said in the introduction, all the movements of Mother are significant. She comes to do a specific work. She didn't go to Japan as a tourist as we come to any other place. So she stayed there in Japan, and what did the mother say? Japan is essentially the country of sensations. She lives through her eyes. Beauty rules over her as an uncontested master, and all her atmosphere incites to mental and vital activity, study, observation, progress, effort, not to silent and blissful contemplation. I ought to say, to complete my picture, that the 4 years I was there, I found a dearth of spirituality and as entire as could be. Now I've read out two important sentences. One is that she finds in Japan an absolute aesthetic beauty. You will see Japanese almost breathe aesthetic sense. They cannot have one little thing out of place. But why did the mother go there? Well, remember, I was going to give you the explanation later, I'll tell you right now. She was born in Paris. What is the meaning of that? She said, I needed that intellectual culture. So, into Paris, into the culture of mind, she brings in the new consciousness. She prepares the... Because you see, you have to understand the whole manifestation like this. That these divine beings don't just start a religion or a big sect or anything. They work for the manifestation of the new higher force on the world level. So they choose one receptive country. So she chose Paris, France, for its intellect. And she prepared that with a stay. And with the same thing, she went to Japan. Because after mind comes the emotion, the aesthetic sense. And Japan is the most advanced country in the world for its aesthetic vital being. And there the mother stays 4 years, prepares that vital world to receive the new light. And therefore, you see how the word she says, Japan is so aesthetic, it's full of Buddhism. But she says, I found a dearth of spirituality as entire as could be. So just being Buddhist, she says, Japanese have no spirituality at all. And then she says, Well, I will skip all that. Well, once in Japan, this is an interesting thing, the Buddha, Sakyamuni, the Buddha appeared to her in Japan. And she was in a mood at that time, very hesitant, because mother had realized so much of spiritual power, but she did not know if she should use it. Then Buddha comes to her, and look at the advice. It's a long passage, but I'll read out the small thing. Buddha says, listen, Buddha is telling the mother, I too hesitated for days, I mean after we got Nirvana, for I could foresee both my preaching and its results, the imperfection of the expression and the still greater imperfection of understanding. Buddha is explaining, mother, that you go and work. She says, and yet I turned to earth and men and brought them my message. Turn to the earth and men. Thy heart carries a blessed message for those who are athirst for compassion. So Buddha goaded the mother saying, you have a tremendous heart of compassion. Go and work with humanity. I know they will not understand you. I know that the words that we express are not right. But he says, I too face that problem. But just because humanity will not understand us fully, it doesn't mean that we keep all our knowledge and compassion to ourselves. We have to share with humanity. So, Meera, she gets a goading there, and from Japan, where she prepares the aesthetic world, she comes down to Pondicherry in 1920, on 24th of April. That's the day of Darshan in Pondicherry. Pondicherry, we have 4 Darshan days. Mother's birthday, 21st February. Sri Aurobindo's birthday, 15th of August. And then we have in December 5th, is the day Sri Aurobindo left his body. And 24th April is the mother's coming. I'm sorry, I gave you a wrong number. 15th of August is Master's birthday. 24th November is the day of Sri Aurobindo's Siddhi, when he realized the Sri Krishna consciousness. And 24th April is the mother's final coming. So, mother came and settled in Pondicherry in 1920. Now you may say, why did she come back? This is a question that we need to ask. She could have gone back from Japan to Paris. But you see the level of her working. In Paris, work on the mind. In Japan, work on the emotion level. And now remains the physical. And for bringing the great new power on the physical level, there is no country in the world as well prepared as India. Well, in the Olympics, we don't have even a bronze medal. It doesn't mean that physical. Physical means not the body, physical consciousness. Remember, for thousands of years, Indian sages have really, really put all the consciousness of spirituality onto the body level, or almost onto the subtle physical level. We on the material level, we may not realize that. We are not good in Olympics, our sports are not good, or physically we are not very tough people. But it is that kind of a spirituality that has made this pavitra, that bhumi of Bharat is so pavitra. So it is on that the new creation can manifest. Because to manifest in the mental level, it can be done anywhere. But that new creation or the new race or the new consciousness needs to be on the earth. And India was that bhumi, which has been prepared since 7,000, 10,000 years. So mother had to come to Pondicherry, not because Sri Aurobindo came, but in her occult level, I will see that later on. So she comes to Pondicherry, and there she starts, not she starts, there began the ashram. And what she did in the ashram, how she developed the ashram, we'll come to a next chapter. But in this one, what I wanted you to understand is this mother's working is not just a physical life. That's why she said, don't concentrate on my physical life. But each of our physical movements has a divine mission. So Pondicherry is not just a place of tourism. It's not one more place. It is the cradle of the new world. And today if you come to Pondicherry, it depends how you come. You come with the tourist eyes, want to take photographs. You come with a critical mind. You see people are indulging in the same fallacies as outside world. Or you come with an open mind, with an open heart. Because you have heard so much about it, let me taste it. And tasting is always staying there for some time. Don't for heaven's sake give a flying visit and come back and tell your friends, oh, Pondicherry is the same. Mr. Reddy came and stole so many things, but it's not the same. You have to stay there, go a little deeper, dip inside the Pondicherry atmosphere, and there you'll benefit. You'll see a new world. And a new world, I don't mean what we are imagining, but the beginnings of a new world. And that's where the whole attempt is. And when we get those relics of the Master to places like this, Wakefield, here and there, we want to bring out a chunk of that atmosphere here. Because not all can come to Pondicherry. But Master has given us an occasion when He can come to you. So create these centers here, not just centers of pradhanas, not just centers of reading, but centers of being and becoming. So even if you have four people, five people, I was discussing with Manik Bhai, don't count on people. It is the center of consciousness. It is not a center of learning. Each center must be developed into a center of consciousness. And there, the relics of Sri Aurobindo, they have an immense radiation of the spiritual atmosphere. It's true that Mother and Sri Aurobindo's photos also have the same effect, but a physical radiation is an important thing. Right? I think we'll stop at that. We can continue tomorrow. Friends, yesterday we had begun our talk on the Mother, her vision and her work. I don't know in these few talks how much of her we can describe. But as I had said yesterday, that this is more an introduction to the newcomers. And if you can at least get an idea, I'd be happy. So in yesterday's description, we are seen to the point where the Mother comes to Pondicherry. So today we shall have the second part of the talk. And let's see what exactly is her work and achievement and mission in Pondicherry. Because as I had said, India is the most fertile land for any spiritual growth. A land prepared by the ancients in the last 10,000 years. In fact, any true spiritual growth has to take its roots in India. And perhaps because of that, the Mother too came down to Pondicherry. And this is where we start in 1926. as you know, the beginning or the starting of the ashram, Sri Aurobindo Ashram at Pondicherry, was in 1926. What exactly happened in 1926 for the ashram to begin? Well, I did not tell you yesterday, but in 1926, on November 24th, Sri Aurobindo had a unique experience. An experience for which he was waiting for quite many years. And until and unless that happened, Sri Aurobindo was not able to go forward in his spiritual attainment. Then exactly on November 24th, there was the great descent of Sri Krishna's consciousness into Sri Aurobindo. Perhaps a few words of explanation would be necessary here. For those of you who have heard my previous talks, you would know that this supramental stage lies beyond the overmind. We have described that there are levels and grades beyond this mind, levels of consciousness, grades of spiritual consciousness. So beyond the mind, the immediate one is the higher mind, then we have the illumined mind, then we have the intuitive mind, then we have the overmind, and then we have the supermind. Well, this is not the occasion when I could describe each of these minds, levels, and tell you what exactly is the difference between these levels. We may think, what does it matter? Many of our saints and yogis have achieved the silence of mind, have achieved the Brahman, have achieved the Jivatman. But all those achievements are absolutely different, because there's no one route to the divine. A divine can be experienced in many facets, either in one facet or in multifacets. So, what Sri Aurobindo describes is the Vedantic way. But as I had told you, even the Vedas had not described these levels so clearly. So, to cut the story brief, so this level of overmind is the penultimate level before the supramental. And Sri Aurobindo was wanting to bring down the supermind into the human level, but for which he has to cross the level of the overmind. And that's what he was waiting for. So in 1926, Sri Krishna, who represents the overmental consciousness, he descended into Sri Aurobindo's physical. In fact, this morning I was telling Manikbhai the exact room where Sri Aurobindo sat. In fact, there is a lot of things we could tell you about that. That morning the mother knew that Sri Krishna is going to descend into Sri Aurobindo. So she sent word to those 24 disciples who were there at the ashram at that time. But as usual, these disciples had gone to play football, to purchase things in the market. They were not aware of anything. So mother sent word saying, call them immediately. And they all rushed back to the ashram. And then mother and Sri Aurobindo sat. Mother sat in front, Sri Aurobindo a little behind. And exactly at that time, they were all sitting in meditation, the 24 sadhaks. And Sri Aurobindo had this experience of the descent of Sri Krishna into the physical. Well, I won't like to really deliberate long on this experience because otherwise, like yesterday, we'll go off the track and we'll not be able to complete our story of the mother. However, this was a very significant achievement. We call this the Siddhi Day. Siddhi means a realization. And after this, Sri Aurobindo was free to go to the supramental level. But that required a lot more concentration, and therefore, what we say, he withdrew from the active days of ashram. I mean, ashram had not yet begun, but active participation with the disciples. He said, I have to concentrate on the supramental. So almost from 1926 to 1950, 24 years, he was seen only 4 times of a year. Rest of the time, he never came out. But that doesn't mean like a normal yogi, he was cut off from the world. No. He had full correspondence, not only with his disciples in Pondicherry, but a lot of inquiries from all over the world and in India. And even a lot of political leaders asked him for his advice. So he was in constant touch with the world. He knew what was happening, especially during the First World War and the Second World War. He knew the news every hour, the BBC news that was being given. So he was following the world events, and there he was putting his spiritual strength and force so that the Allies get the victory. However, that's a different story. For our part, from this date onwards, the mother was put in charge. The disciples were told that from now on, whatever your needs, both the material and the spiritual needs, will be looked after by the mother. So, the task of forming the ashram, the task no doubt is a formidable one, said the mother. But we receive the command to accomplish it, and we are upon earth for that purpose alone. We shall continue up to the end with an unfailing trust in the will and the help of the Supreme. So this is where we left yesterday. This was the beginning of the ashram. It is said that Sri Aurobindo considered for 3 days before deciding upon the name of Sri Aurobindo Ashram to the community of seekers growing around him. For it was not meant to be the ashram in the usual sense of the term. It was meant to be an ashram in the Vedic sense, that is, the house of the teacher where the students and disciples gather to draw inspiration from him to learn how to find God. So Sri Aurobindo Ashram is not an exclusively meditative center, as one would imagine with the usual terminology of the ashram. So it is a miniature world in itself. Sri Aurobindo's idea of starting a Devasangha was thus realized in 1926. The mother too had dreamt of establishing such a community. She says, I was very young at that time and I always used to tell myself that if ever I could do it, I would try to create a little world where people would be able to live without having to be preoccupied with food and lodging and clothing and the imperative necessities of life, so as to see whether all the energies freed by this certainty of a secure material living would turn spontaneously towards the divine life and the inner realizations. Well, towards the middle of my life, the means was given to me and I could realize this, that is, create such conditions of life. Well, I would say this is an extremely important thing. She had a long back dream, because she saw in the world that normally people spend all the time in earning and spending or trying to earn and live. That means trying to get food, clothing, shelter and some necessities. And therefore, whomever she asked, they said, Mother, we do have time to do pujas, to do meditations. All through the day I have to go through my job, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. So in this rut of our life, we have no time for God. So then she imagined, if I provide people with these basic necessities, will they be able to concentrate on God? So that was a dream, and with that dream, she takes up the building of Sri Aurobindo Ashram. So that's why she gives to the ashramites the lodging, boarding, basic necessities, not luxuries, necessities. And those of you have seen the ashram, you see, ashram is not an ascetic place. It has good rooms, there's a fan in every room, good food, clean clothes, laundry, a bakery, a dining room, maybe 60 departments, right from perfumes to repair of shoes to hair cutting to industries. So it's a small world that she created. But then the question is, has it fulfilled its purpose or not? That is where we have to see, and that's what you come and see yourselves. How much has it succeeded? And if so, why and why not? Well, the mother had told about this dream of hers in 1956. 30 years had passed since the founding of the ashram, and these years were one of the great labor supported and enthused by divine love. Well, in the beginning, right in 1926, when the mother took charge of the ashram, what she did, she wanted to experiment a great thing. She brought down the overmental gods, like we have the Vedic gods, Indra, Varuna, Mitra, Agni. And these gods possessed some people in the ashram. She thought, we always look forward to gods and say that they have immense power. This Indra is a tremendously powerful god, or Varuna is somebody. So she said, let me bring down these gods and bring them to human beings and see what happens, how much man can progress. Well, that was a very beautiful period where people immediately enjoyed peace, joy, ananda. People became overnight poets, artists, musicians, painters, tremendous physical strength. I mean, they didn't do anything. It was like a magic wand. Overnight, people didn't recognize themselves. So it was a very short period, a brilliant phase of the ashram. But then Sri Aurobindo said, and if we had stopped there, we could have started a big religion or a vast organization, commented Sri Aurobindo. But the real work would have been left unattempted and unachieved. So Sri Aurobindo told the mother, this is good. Maybe within a few years, we'll have a greater religion than Hinduism or Christianity or Islam. Within 100 years, we'll have a great religion. But then the question is, are we here to make one more religion? Or are we here to bring down the supermind and bring down a new race of human beings, change human nature? So he tells mother, take it out. Withdraw the gods. So mother narrates, she went back to her room and it took her almost 3 hours to withdraw these gods, and the human beings were sort of, they fell with a thud on earth. They were back to their normalcy. So they couldn't write a line of poem, they couldn't hold their painting brush. They were back to where they were. But Sri Aurobindo says, this is what is important, that human beings have to grow with their own effort. Miracles is no good. Because it's good, maybe I have a lot of poetry, I may consider myself the greatest poet. So what? You will be one more poet on earth, maybe one more name in the encyclopedia. But will it do any good to human nature? So Sri Aurobindo said, no, you have to do the work yourselves. And therefore, they were back to their normal work, and the ashram began after that. And Sri Aurobindo said, the new dispensation meant first an unquestioning acceptance of her as the mother, second a total surrender to her of one's whole life, and third a ready and happy submission of the discipline laid down by her for the smooth and efficient functioning of the ashram. Well, this was, you know, in the beginning, you can very well imagine the condition in 1924. Mother was an European lady coming from France. Here was Sri Aurobindo, an Indian yogi, and he was not yet considered anything more than a great literary master, a great yogi, but nothing beyond that. Not even a guru. In fact, like it happened with Arjuna and Sri Krishna, his own colleagues would call him A.G. A.G. means Aurobindo Ghosh. Some people would call him Sir. So this question of a devotion or devote to guru, yogi, nothing was there. So at this instance, when this mother took over the ashram, there was initially a resistance. Some people said, why? Who is this mother? And of course, there were few, like Champak Bhai, Champak Lalji, who recognized immediately in the mother the great divine aspect. But there were very few. So for the rest who were asking Sri Aurobindo questions, who this mother is? Why should we think that she is a divine being? There are many questions, and Sri Aurobindo in response came out with this small booklet called the Mother. Well, this is not a book written. There were questions and answers later on compiled. But this book answered all the questions, and then for the first time Sri Aurobindo put together in chapter 6 the full description of who the mother is in her spiritual reality. So for those of you who have not read it and who would like to know the mother, this is the Bible for that. And it's a short book, but it gives you the intense depth of the mother's true nature. Well, it will take a lot of explanation to read this. It's not so easy. It's simple reading. But today my next talk would be based on what I read here, the true mother. Otherwise, we don't know who she is, but what Sri Aurobindo told us is written here. So indeed, the mother is both human and divine. The best form that the divine can take to help out her suffering children is the form of a mother. So the divine mother leaned towards the human dimension of the sadhaks, won their hearts and minds, and slowly gathered their souls and led them on a spiritual path. As a mother, she took all the sadhaks, all those who turned to her for help and succor, by their hand and guided them, taught them how to transcend their littlenesses and become greater, purer, nobler spiritual seekers. She was a miracle of love and grace and compassion, which were transmuted into her smile, the smile that is supremely divine and supremely human, the utmost elevation of both becoming one. Well, here you will see a couple of descriptions regarding the mother's smile. And I watched that. Because we who have seen the mother, what we remember of her is that extraordinary smile. A smile that would capture your soul. A smile, I mean, it's only the divine who can smile like that. I mean, you go in your deepest of sorrows, deepest of depression, but as she described somewhere, a smile that dissolves all clouds. So in her eyes you could see the brilliant smile. You have a lot of photographs here. You can see the eyes and the smile. And all those who came in contact with the mother of love became her slave of love. One of the sadhikas, she writes, at the very first glance, although hers was a human material body, yet it became quite clear to me that hers was rather an incarnated divine form. As she bestowed her heavenly smile and looked at me, I bent to place my head on her feet. The touch of her hand on my head seemed to melt the whole of my being in an inner ecstasy. Yes, friend, this is somebody who wrote right in 1930s and 40s, a sadhika who had come. Sadhika means a lady who had joined the ashram early years. But we who went much later, this is a common experience of all of us. That when we went to her, when we put our head on her feet or on her knees, when she blessed her with her hand, I mean, we really forgot the world, we forgot the time. And therefore, we came out not knowing where we had been. We knew we were going into the mother's room. But when we came out, we didn't know who we were, where we were. It was completely a different experience. In one of her letters, the basis of mother-child relationship was the pouring of the nectar of her incomparable smile on all who sought her shelter. Once Sadhika was in a deep depression and the mother soothed her sorrow, writing to her, "Poor little one, I very gladly take you on my lap and cradle you to my heart to soothe this heavy sorrow which has no cause. Let me take you in my arms, bathe you in my love, and wipe away even the memory of the incident." To all her children, the mother declared, "The only mystery, the only spell is my love which is spread over my children and calls down upon them the divine's grace to help and to protect." She came to be known in the ashram as Douce Mère, that is in French, which means sweet mother. Or some Bengalis would call her Madhumai Ma. That is again the same thing, sweet mother. She was never called as a mother. We always called her Douce Mère. And she became the center and soul of the ashram. People from all over India came, some in response to their inner call and others for a glance, a touch, a smile of the mother, or to spend a few ingathered hours in the ashram's precincts. She too reached out to her children, her devotees, her disciples to the extent they could receive her and grace. Oftentimes she used to stop in her actions, for she would go out in a subtle body to help someone in deep distress. So this was, you will read in Mother's works, it used to happen many times that when she was giving blessings, talking to somebody, or even going in the playground, she would suddenly halt. And it would be 10 minutes, 15 minutes, even half an hour. And once I read here, it took 3 hours. She used to go into a trance. But what kind of trance? Not that meditative trance where you want to go your Brahman consciousness or... Her trance was to reach out to human cause. In fact, there is a letter from Sri Aurobindo himself here, who says mother reached out, I mean simultaneously, to hundreds of calls for help. She says, always calls of this kind are coming to the mother, sometimes 100 close upon each other, and always the answer is given. The occasions are of all kinds, but whatever the need that occasions the call, the force is there to answer. At the same time, it is not an impersonal force, and the suggestion of a divine energy that is there ready to answer and satisfy anybody who calls it is not at all relevant here. It is something personal to the mother, and if she had not this power and this kind of action, she would not be able to do her work. That is to say, that each time there was an intense call from any part of the world, she had to respond to that call. And sometimes that call is so intense, and there are so many at a time, that she had to stop her physical action. Otherwise, she could go and respond to any call. But many a time, she would stop what she was doing. And in fact, some people, she was just giving a blessing like that, and she stopped 20 minutes with a hand resting like that. So people would stand there for 20 minutes, half an hour, and then she would come back and continue. So this is, well, this was very common to her. One day, a disciple, P, developed a tumor on her thigh. When she complained about her pain to Sri Aurobindo, he replied, "Pray inside." She tried her best, and even at the end of 3 months, there were no signs of any improvement. Her husband, out of desperation, told her, "If your leg does not heal, we will get it amputated. She was mortified and gasped in prayer, "Lord, either kill me or cure me." That night, she saw Sri Aurobindo and the mother in her dream. The mother caressed her leg, and Sri Aurobindo pulled her leg with a jerk. Immediately her pain vanished, and she could go to her work on the very next day. Well, this is just one incident to tell you how in the subtle physical, how in dreams, how in visions, they come and help. Well, in fact, a very personal experience I would tell you. Recently, when my father was operated for cancer, and it was a terminal stage, the doctors had given up. Well, I just prayed to her to protect him, help him. And one evening, one night, when I was retiring to bed and prayed, I saw a vision of the mother where I saw her sitting beside my father and scooping away the disease from his stomach. She did thrice the scooping act. Well, today is 3 months, a little more, and the disease has almost vanished. Well, we all know who has done that. So this is a rare example with me, which is I have experienced myself. But here is a book. I brought this book, in fact, to show you that these are collections of such incidents. There are 3 or 4 volumes of this. I mean, which really tell us her infinite grace, her immediate answer, her immediate response to all our prayers. It may be, as Sri Aurobindo himself says, the commonest illness or your circumstantial difficulties. See, he says, this has been seen by sadhaks not only here, but far away, and not only for inner difficulties, but for illness and outer pressure of unfavorable circumstance. But there's one thing that the mother and Sri Aurobindo always said, that the mother does and can know your difficulties, but it is necessary, he says, to call her. And well, right here, I got the quotation right here. Mother said, "Yes, I am always with you, but you must never forget to call me, for it is by calling me that the presence becomes effective." You see, like the oxygen in the air, the presence is everywhere. But because the oxygen is there, it doesn't mean it's going into your lungs. You have to breathe. You inhale that air, and then that oxygen becomes effective in your body. So prayer is that kind of inhaling the divine pervasive presence. That's why she says you have to call. So don't say mother is there, she will look after. But just oxygen is there, I'm not living. So there is a process of taking in the oxygen. But similarly, she says you have to pray. You have to call me. And even in the ashram, there are letters where Sri Aurobindo writes, it is very important sometimes to write down your problem. Write a letter. And then he says, almost instantly, come right here. Yeah, I'm sorry, this is the same one.